Welcome to another episode of the Tearsheet Podcast, where we explore financial services together with an eye on technology, innovation, emerging models, and changing expectations. I'm Tearsheet Editor-in-Chief, Zach Miller. Today, I invite you to join us as we uncover the story of Curve, a creative fintech that's a sort of operating system for money, impacting the way people spend, send, see, and save money. Step into the world of Shachar Bialik, founder and CEO of Curve, as we traverse the company's path from its humble beginnings in 2016 to its strategic expansion into international markets recently. It's a tale of resilience, grit, and determination as Curve works to carve out its place in a competitive fintech space. And along the way, we uncover five pivotal insights that shed light on Curve's approach. From offering customers a real-time panoramic view of their finances, to navigating the complexities of international expansion with precision and foresight, Curve is reworking the way people interact with their money. Shachar shares the intricacies of Curve's revenue model, where interchange fees, subscriptions, and platform revenue converge to create an ecosystem of financial empowerment. It's a model built on innovation, adaptability, and a pursuit of customer-centric solutions. But beyond the numbers and metrics lie a deeper story of personal motivation and resilience. As Shachar shares insights from his own journey, we gain a glimpse of the driving force behind Curve's success, a shared commitment to empower individuals to take more control of their financial destinies. So, join us as we peel back the layers of Curve's story, uncovering the passion, vision, and sheer determination that have propelled this fintech to get to where it is today. Here's my conversation with Curve's Shachar Bialik. Great. So, who are you and what do you do?
Hi, Zach. Thanks for accommodating me. My name is Shachar Bialik. I'm the founder and CEO of Curve. I started Curve about 8 years ago. And the idea behind Curve is quite groundbreaking and very ambitious. Our mission is to build an operating system for money. Some call it a financial super app. Some call it a super wallet. And our mission is to be the one-stop shop for all of consumers' financial needs. If you'd like a single point of access to one range of financial products and services bundled together into one single interface. And unlike any other service in the market today, we don't ask customers to change their bank or move their finances and servicing to another supplier provider, but rather connect all their existing financial products from their cards to bank accounts into one single interface. And from that moment on, supercharge their finances by enabling customers to unthink money. We empower customers to get more value for their money, reducing their borrowing cost, earning more rewards, doing more savings, saving more fees when they travel abroad, for example. And all in all, the unique position of Curve enables us to build what many today believe the end game for finance would be, which is a rebundling of the market into a single interface for everything money, which is very similar to what happened in other markets like shopping with Amazon, music with Spotify, and so forth.
Well, welcome to the podcast. I'm happy to talk to you. I think we spoke years ago, and I'm happy to catch up with you now. I want to get into the particulars about Curve in a bit, but I want to take, maybe we'll start our conversation with a broader lens and looking at what's happening in the market, right? So we've been doing at Tearsheet a lot of coverage on the emergence of Gen Z and young customers into the space and the different expectations they have, Shachar, than people older, people my age with these gray hairs. What's happening? Like, what are the new demands on financial services? What are young people looking for from providers in the space?
It's a great question. If you take generational comparison and the generation of my parents to my generation, or even the Gen Z generation, which is younger than me, I was born in 81, I'm a millennial, per the segmentation, and the younger generation, we are more comfortable to leave our bank account and look for other suppliers. We're more comfortable to fragment our experience and get the best deals from different suppliers. Whereas our parents, if you remember, they had one bank account, the same branch since they were 16 until they were 60 years old. This is where the children had a bank account and they consumed all the services from that bank account. Today's generation, they're aware that one bank cannot offer you everything. And there's a lot of different new providers coming to the market in the past 20 years, and especially the past 10 years in what we call today fintech. They offer you better, faster, cheaper. And indeed, you see many of us, millennials and Gen Z, onboarding and and sourcing different products and different services. You can source TransferWise to move money abroad instead of using your bank to move money abroad. You can use PayPal to pay online safely instead of using your bank card directly. You can use Plum in the UK for saving instead of using your bank for ISA and savings. And the challenge with that is that at the same time, customers are comfortable to source financial products from different suppliers. At the same time, their expectation, as you rightly said, is to converge everything to one single interface. They are not lazy in any sense, but lazy in the mindset of what they expect. They all have what you call today the Amazon effect. They want one-stop shop for everything commerce, one-stop shop of everything music like Spotify, one-stop shop for everything travel like booking. And similarly, they're expecting one-stop shop for finance. Now, if you connect the dots together, you find the problem. In one way, the customer expectation is to have a single interface to everything money, as they have with Spotify and Amazon. But on the other hand, they do want to keep the ability to discover and onboard to a host of financial services and not one supplier. So there is a challenge of how you create a single point of distribution with many producer of content. And that brings us basically to Curve and the strategy we formed, which is very similar to the strategy of Spotify, Amazon, and the rest have taken. And it's also aligned on a market strategy that has been proven empirically in the market over and over again, that markets usually move in a pendulum movement between rebundling, unbundling, and rebundling again. And yeah, their new rebundlers are usually new category kings.
Yeah, I'm glad you used that language about rebundling and rebundling. It's something we've talked about here on this podcast a lot. So you're describing a scenario where younger people are searching for point solutions that serve their needs. And because of that, they've got a bunch of point solutions that they need tied together. And obviously there are APIs and those point solutions themselves are trying to be, you know, part of an open finance ecosystem, but they're inside of it, right? They're not necessarily on top of it. I do want to ask you, does it have an impact also on loyalty? How do you think about loyalty when you're serving this generation? If they're really searching for, you know, best of breed products, can you possibly be best of breed in everything?
So number one, I don't believe one company could provide everything, especially not in the financial space. So the winner-take-all strategy, which is not surprisingly, or surprisingly, depends on which position you look at, is the majority of financial institutions and fintechs are taking. Revolut is a good example. Mm-hmm. They tell you, leave all your banks, leave everything behind you. Amex is shit, Discover is shit, MasterCard is shit. Come to me, I'll give you everything in one place. We have no empirical evidence of any.
Even a phone plan. Yet. We'll give you a phone
exactly,
plan.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And they did a great job in execution. It went wrong, but it's unlikely to become your single interface to everything money because those customers of Revolut use it as a secondary card for a specific ad hoc jobs to be done. Whereas they still have the breakfast account where the checking of the salary goes to the checking account. They still have mm-hmm. a loan from RBS. They still have a pension plan somewhere else. And the reason a winner-take-all won't work, aside from the empirical evidence that companies in the past tried winner-take-all strategy in markets which are much easier, unregulated, and failed, is because this market of finance is regulated. And in this market of finance, affordability and credit risk posture and strategy means a lot. Therefore, we've never seen an example of one lender, just taking one piece of that, able to serve everyone, subprime and prime. And when we saw lender trying to do that, they failed miserably.
Inevitably, yeah.
Right? So, and moreover, to be the single point of access to everything money, you have to be in the financial space, you have to get regulation authorization in each and every region, which basically means you need to believe that company would be able to move fast enough, assuming winner-take-all strategy would work, ahead of any other competitor who saw how successful they are and getting authorization to those new markets. And we know in some markets, authorization takes a long time to get, and it's pretty intensive process. The US is a good example for that. So with those winner-take-all strategy, we don't have empirical evidence, yet everyone else is doing those activities and strategies. However, if you look at the rebundling market of music or shopping or booking, the right strategy that worked there is a strategy of aggregation. What does it mean? It basically means Spotify does not tell you, come to me, the best music you never heard in the world is with me because you're never going to sign up to Spotify. The first, I need to have access to connect you with the music you love, Depeche Mode, The Stones, so you can access. And as soon as you access that and you engage with the product, they learn about you through the data, and then they're moving slowly to production and cross and upselling to you products that either they produce themselves, new podcasts and sorts, or products that their partners providing them. And the same model also worked with Amazon, where they have the marketplace of goods from different partners, and slowly Amazon with the data, so which products they can create better value to customers, the cheaper cost. Batteries is a good example. And they're creating Amazon basic branded batteries and selling you, competing private with their label. Own marketplace, right? Mm-hmm. Private label. So the same, we believe, will happen in finance, but to do it in finance, and that's one of the reasons you won't see many companies like Curve, at least successful one. We have a graveyard of companies behind us. And
yeah, I was going to say, history has been littered with companies that tried to do what you're trying to do.
Exactly. And they all failed. And the main reason they failed is because what we're doing is really, really hard. And it's really hard because it requires us to solve a complex coalition problem, as they call it. We need to get companies like Visa and MasterCard, just as an example, who are gatekeepers in the payment space by definition, and quite a duopoly, if you'd like, to change the rules and align their interests with ours, where our interests are not necessarily aligned. So which means we have to accommodate our strategy to support those gatekeepers while changing their point of view and following the rules that enable us to operate. And indeed, if you look at 2012, when Google tried to do what we did and failed, they failed because Visa blocked them. And we were actually successful in turning around Visa, changing the rules, and becoming partners with Visa, a principal member of Visa in Europe. So if you take it all together, we were able to solve a complex coalition problem and bring all the parties you have to bring to create this aggregation aligned with our interests to be able to solve that problem and give better value to our customers.
It sounds almost like what you're saying, Shachar, is that you may need to continuously keep solving the complex coalition problem, because does it ever really end?
Yes, it does. It does when the market settles. The strategy of how to solve the complex coalition problem in finance was actually inspired by Spotify playbook. Historically, when Spotify started, they had to get access to all the content, and the content was owned by the gatekeepers, which was Universal Music, Sony Music, Warner Music.
All the rights holders.
And you can imagine, exactly, all the rights holders. And you can imagine what happened when Spotify went to the US and tried to get access. They got blocked.
I've seen the documentary. Spotify. Yeah.
There you go. I haven't seen the documentary yet, but I did talk with the CEO back then.
Daniel.
Daniel. And when what they did, they went back to Sweden, because in Sweden, which also happened to be their home country, had protection from the law on accessing rights. And luckily for them, or not, because they predicted it, the European Commission adopted the same Swedish law for IP across all of European Commission. So now mm-hmm. Spotify could operate across all of Europe and start building product market fit and generate revenue and attract more investors to be able to grow faster. And at the same time, they were able to build relationship, and most importantly, to show, to break the myth at the executive level of Warner and Universal that there's nothing much to be afraid of. It's a natural evolution of music from vinyl to CD and now to digital format. And thanks to this relationship building and trust, we're able to passport Spotify a relationship with those gatekeepers, rights owner globally. And today, the challenge no longer exists, really. I'm sure there's some discussion behind the scenes every once in a while about the business model, but largely, they solved it because the category king has emerged, Spotify, and the market has subsided. That we're now at the end of rebundling of music. And we are now kind of midway of rebundling in our way. And indeed, we managed to get the two biggest players in the market. There's one player, we're not there yet, American Express, but we're working hard to get them on board. But largely in Europe, they're not such a big player, not that meaningful. In the US, however, in the big cities, they are like New York, Philadelphia, San Francisco, they are.
Can you be more explicit about what the issue is about them being part of Curve?
So there's a lot of conversation, and I'll try and share what's public.
Sure.
The history with Curve and Amex is that Curve is based on the MasterCard network, the Curve card, and Curve is a layer 3 product, which means we are over the top of anyone, any other issuer in the world. Curve customers could load their Amex card into Curve and use Amex everywhere, even if the merchant does not accept Amex. That in turn have increased Amex cross transaction volume, Amex revenue, Amex uptake of subscription like the platinum card, and also for the customer of Amex increased their rewards and therefore more loyalty and engagement.
But you just as easily could decide not to use Amex, right? I guess that's the issue.
You could, but because Amex is the most rewarding card in the market and they have remarkable service and brand, customers that have Amex would like to use Amex wherever possible. The problem is that it's really hard to use Amex outside of London. If you go to continental Europe, Germany or France, for example, you have literally signs on the point of sale, on the till, that they don't accept Amex. So on the face of it, Amex should support Curve and want to be with us. But obviously, it didn't work until now. And why not? Because if you open Amex annual report and you just look for the words closed-loop network or three-party network, it appears like 200 times in the annual report, which tells you something, which is Amex is leading the market on the premise that their model of three-party network creates them more certainty with regulation, more strength with the merchant, more control, more like a closed-loop Apple versus open-loop Google, right? That's kind of how they try to compare that. However, if Amex, in a way, if you like, agrees to partner with Curve, and Curve is a MasterCard, de facto, what Amex sends as a note to the market is that Amex needs to have MasterCard in order to be accepted anywhere in the international market. Mm. And that's not good news.
That's a signaling issue.
It's a signaling issue.
Yeah,
exactly. And of course, they have one of the most wonderful brands in the world, not just in the financial space, over 150 years ago old. So they care deeply about the brand and something we truly understand. So to solve that, again, complex coalition problem, we have to find means to change in our strategy and product that enables us to work with Amex and meet their concerns, legitimate concerns. And we have some good people there at Amex. And they do see that they need to tap into the Gen Z more, and they're losing a customer base because the Gen Z not that involved with Amex as much as millennials or Gen X, and they see the path to get there potentially with Curve. And we're working hard to try and find a solution that will work for both Amex, Curve, Amex card members, and Curve customers.
Got it. And so what issue did you have with the duopoly to help solve for them? I mean, they're more open, obviously, than Amex. Like, what worked for them that didn't necessarily work for Amex? The public, so, you know, you can share publicly, of course.
Amex, Curve, sorry, MasterCard is a four-party model as Visa. And as a four-party model, they're by definition cheaper than Amex, mainly because of interchange caps in Europe, for example. Mm-hmm. And their acceptance is close to 100% globally, whereas Amex is less than 20% globally. So with MasterCard and Visa, this issue of acceptance is actually the benefit. It's not an issue. But what we're doing, we are creating a layer 3, an over-the-top network on top of all the layer 2s, which are Visa, MasterCard, Amex, Discover Diners, SEPA, ACH. These are all layer 2 networks. And the layer 1s are the banks you're familiar with, the financial institutions. And if Curve becomes the layer 3, it basically means de facto Curve disintermediates Visa and MasterCard. And the opportunity with MasterCard was that we were able to get MasterCard the forefront of Curve, the card, the network, which is in front of everyone else, which makes, of course, uncomfortable to Visa because Visa is behind MasterCard. But after many years of back and forth with Visa, we were eventually able to find a way forward. Then you would see later this year, the Curve card will not only be MasterCard network card, it will also be Visa network card. Right. We're going to share the volumes across them because we want to make Visa make money. We're using the network, we're using the services. We then need to make money from this new emerging category we're creating.
So I'd love to double click on like the value of being a third layer or over the top. Yeah. Obviously, like you're describing that scenario, you're almost like load balancing. You can funnel traffic and payment flow towards different networks. What are some of the other things they can do by sitting on top that other networks can't because they're layer down?
Yeah, so I use comparison of Curve to another wallet like Apple Pay, and I will use Curve as a comparison to another layer one like Revolut or Barclays. Yeah. So the first thing is that
I love speaking to you, by the way, because most of the guests on the show are American, so like all the examples you're giving are very much British. So I appreciate that.
We can also use Chime or it doesn't matter; it's the same. But as a layer three, you have a lot of value. Number one, by being a layer three, that means you're only connecting to layer twos, to the networks themselves, which means by definition, any layer one product can be connected to the platform, to Curve. So you can load your card into Curve wherever the card is, from Saudi, even from Mars, as long as the bank on Mars is connected to one of the layer twos we connected, Visa, MasterCard, Diners, Discover, and so forth. So number one, 100% coverage. Number two, when you create layer three, you basically create an entire ecosystem below you, fungible, interoperable with each other, which by definition means that you only have one form factor you can pay with. And indeed, all your cards in one. One what? One app, one card, one ring, one iris, doesn't matter. You have one form factor that basically load balances, you called it, transition, distribute the cost, or the transaction, the relevant pot. If the pot is account, the pot is an issuer, whatever it may be. More importantly then, once you are sitting as a layer three, the customer doesn't need to change their behaviors. All other layer ones tell you, hey, leave your bank, come to me, I'll give you everything better, faster, cheaper, which probably is correct, but the bar of leaving your bank and moving into a new fintech is pretty high because with all the respect, your bank is doing a great job.
Right. Or now, it's easy. It's pretty low to open a new account, but to use it is the high bar, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. But also trust and despair. You see, in the UK, for example, we have more than 5 years now, automatic account switching.
Switching, right.
One tap switch, less than 5% switched.
I've seen the data. Yeah.
It's very low. Exactly because of that. Because in the end, the job of your bank is to keep your money safe. That's it. All the other things you expect your bank to do is a myth. It's not really the job of the bank. The job of the bank is to make money. But the first job of the bank is to multiply money to the economy. Therefore, keep your money safe. And your bank is doing a pretty good job with that, right? Mm-hmm. Most of the banks in the Western world are keeping your money safe. So there's no really good reason to leave your bank. So with Curve, you don't have to leave your bank. You can connect other banks to Curve and keep using them. But now we're supercharging your experience. How so? I'll give you another example. As a customer, I want to travel to Europe to a vacation with a family. We already know by data that most customers who are traveling with their family for a half-time vacation or Christmas vacation, they're using a credit card to manage their cash flow. They don't have enough money and savings to spend for the vacation, so they're taking a loan from the credit card and managing that over time. So as a customer, I'm traveling to Paris with my family now. I have to choose. If I use my Barclays card, I get access to my credit line and rewards, but I would pay 3% in FX fees, in currency conversion fee. If I use a product like TransferWise, I would be able to save the 2% in FX fees. However, I will not be able to access my credit line and rewards. I have to choose, right? A layer one is competing with each other. Mm-hmm. It's me against Chase.
And it's all or nothing. I don't think,
exactly. I don't think it's the right thing to do. But more importantly, as a startup, I don't think anyone really has a chance against Barclays or Chase. It's really hard. Big brands, big banks, really hard to take market. Not impossible, but really, really hard to take market share from them. So, but with Curve, you don't have to choose. With Curve, connect your Barclays card to Curve, go abroad, spend with your Barclays card through Curve. You keep getting access to your credit line and earning rewards. But now Curve has eliminated your FX fees. It's now zero. Curve has the capability, technology, to be able to eliminate any hidden fees from your underlying card while continuing to gain and enjoy the benefits of that underlying card, which is a unique capability Curve has. Another example, which has to do with the load balancing you mentioned, is a Curve customer can go back in time. A Curve customer made a transaction with the Barclays card through Curve in day one. They can decide 60 days later or 120 days later to go back in time and move this transaction to a different card. And they do it because they want to reduce their borrowing cost, they want to pay with the right card,
or
they want to maximize the rewards, right? So they can go back in time. These are just some examples of what Curve can do as a layer three that others can't. And if you compare it to the wallets like Samsung or Apple, we are a much better wallet because Apple Pay doesn't allow you to eliminate hidden fees. Apple Pay doesn't give you the security of the Curve card to front all your wallets. So if your Curve card gets lost, you don't have to cancel all your cards, just cancel the Curve card and get a new one connected. It doesn't allow you to double dip reward, earn rewards on top of your underlying cards rewards. It doesn't allow you to go back in time. Yet it does give you the all your card in one experience like you have with Apple Pay. So Curve is, and also the coverage. We have support of all the banks, whereas Apple Pay only banks. So they support it and did direct relationship with them. So being a layer three give us a full fungibility of all finance. We basically move the entire finance to the cloud and give you everything, one-stop shop for everything with limited behavioral change and maximizing your benefits. It's very much a no-brainer. Why wouldn't I use it?
It sounds that way. As CEO and sort of, it feels to me very much you have very much a product background. Like I see you get excited as you're describing it. how do you determine where to step in and at layer three to be able to determine like this new type of functionality, like you talked about, like shifting back in time? Like, where do you step in and create something new, and where do you just kind of allow things to evolve?
So Curve is not what you call steering the customer to the right card. Number one, it's illegal by the networks to steer customers. Mm-hmm. And also, we cannot really steer customers because we don't really know why they're spending with a card. For example, I can decide for you automatically what is the card that will give you the most reward. So for example, if you're at a restaurant and you have Chase, I will charge that card because it will maximize the rewards. But maybe you were at a restaurant for a business transaction and Chase is a personal card. Mm-hmm. And the business Barclays debit card is the card you want to use. So if I would choose for you, a bit of a nuisance. It's not going to be a good experience. So what we've done, however, we created a product called Smart Rules and patented it. So the customer can create rules. If this and that. If I'm in a restaurant, use my Chase card. If Monday to Friday I'm abroad, use my business debit card. If amount over 100 pounds and it's groceries, use my joint account. They're going to create new rules that basically reduce borrowing costs, maximize rewards, and just unthink money. And that's a thread you would see in Curve, because you want the customers to enjoy life, celebrate life. And money sometimes is a weight, and especially when you have to budget and manage it. And what you want customers to have is their own personal CFO that looks at their data, tells them, hey, you should do that or that. What do you want to do?
Right, they just recommendations without deciding.
And, okay. And then we do that. And in Smart Rules, second iteration of Smart Rules later in the year, you would see that we give you a recommendation of rules you could adopt that will maximize rewards, reduce borrowing cost based on your wallet's composition. So if in your wallet you have Chase and someone else in the community of Curve created a rule for Chase and restaurant, you would see that rule being recommended to you to adopt it. So we help you also with that here to educate you. It's impossible through an app, I think, but we're here to help you and recommend you what to do to maximize your value, your maximize your perceived value from your money.
We've definitely seen a slew of startups move into the IFTTT, you know, if this, then that type model. And just with smart routing, like you're talking about, it seems like from where you sit, it makes so much sense to be able to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. We see the one of the biggest advantages of Curve, again, versus any other a layer one company, as we call it, another bank or issuer, mm-hmm. or even any other wallet. Especially any other wallets like Apple Pay or Google Pay, because they do not see the data itself. The data passing through their system, they can't get access to that. It was one of the requirements from the banks in the US when the rules were made by Visa, MasterCard. So one of the things unique to Curve is that we see a 360 view of your finances. In real time, we know exactly how you look across all your accounts from anywhere in the world, business versus personal. And we can see, for example, in real time, when you try to pay for a transaction with your debit card, you got a decline because of insufficient fund, mm-hmm. and then you move to a credit card. So mm-hmm. now you use this credit card because you have a problem with your debit account. And this real-time data allows us to create much better affordability models. And with this better affordability model, we're in a better position to help the customer reduce the borrowing cost, to be more responsible with the finances, and also target or connect the customer with the right lender that has the right risk affordability mix that would fit best to the customer. Moreover, it's not ending there. This is just the targeting. Because we have all the data on identity and KYC, which is big, then we're able to onboard the customer to this third-party developer, third-party partner with one tap, because we're able, with customer permission, to share all the data required to onboarding with a partner who can then onboard them into a relevant product. It's pretty beautiful.
It is. Tell me why you went international. It feels like pretty early in Curve's evolution. How important is international expansion to your strategy?
So let's just make sure we get the timeline right. So we launched in beta in 2016 under mm-hmm. waiver by MasterCard in the UK, only for commercial markets, for small business, solopreneurs, freelancers. In September 2017, it was when we were able to change the rules of MasterCard. And 2018 January, we launched out of beta in the UK and Europe. So first expansion into Europe. In 2020, we began the expansion into 2021, the expansion into the US. Mm-hmm. And right now we have a beta program in the US with about 2,000 customers. It's really under wrap. We're learning. We're waiting to make sure it's the right moment and we have sufficient resources to deliver that. The main focus of the company really has been to Europe and the UK, getting the company to break even and growing the market share we have in the European region. But indeed, the US for us is a large market because number one, it's the ultimate market for finance. It's extremely fragmented. The offering there are very legacy. In fact, the most of the Gen Z indeed do not have proper solution to their expectations. And if you look at the accelerant of a customer with Curve, you would find that number of cards you have, how fragmented you are, is more likely to use Curve and love Curve. Earning rewards, and Curve gives you rewards from your underlying card plus rewards from Curve, double dip, like George Costanza. And rewards in the US is like 9 out of 10 customers choosing the main card based on the rewards, and Curve is a no-brainer. It's the ultimate card. So the US is the ultimate market for Curve, but the US also has a lack of competition law. The DOJ is one entity, which is very simple. The gatekeepers there are very strong. But it took us a while to get there. And to really get to the market, you have to do some more work on the product there and invest much resources. So long story short, international expansion is important for us. But we're not in a rush to get anywhere. And the reason we're not in a rush is because we have a real moat. There's a reason there's no other company behind us. There's many dead companies behind us, but not live ones, successful ones. And we have a unique differentiator. But at the same time, if you truly want to come to us for money, and you have to choose your markets, because I just told you, unlikely one winner will take all markets because of regulation. So the markets we chose, of course, North America, Latin America, UK, Europe, and then the GCC region in time. And US, of course, is the next immediate market for Curve.
Got it. And can we talk about your revenue model and how you're generating money? Because I know you moved into subscriptions as well. Can we talk about the different components there?
Yeah, of course. So largely speaking, Curve has three revenue channels, mm-hmm. and two of them will be very familiar to you. The first one is the interchange model. The interchange model is nice to have. I don't think it's something that will continue for many, many, many years in the future. However, it's very nice to allow you to bootstrap and require less burn from equity money from fundraising. Mm-hmm. The second one is indeed from a subscription where customers can get more or better of Curve. And you have several tiers there. You have the Curve X, which is the initial tier, Curve Black, Curve Metal. And each one of them gives you a bit more FX, a bit more go back in time, more time dilation.
And is, features, it's a freemium model. Is there a free version as well?
There is a free version as well.
Okay.
So that's subscription. And the third one is what we call platform revenue. And platform revenue is really catch all. And the business model, you have to think about it, think of it Curve like a marketplace, affiliate model, where we help customers to discover new financial products and services and onboard on them. And the financial provider is paying us an affiliate fee. So today you would find their revenue like merchant kickbacks when we help merchants get more volumes of spend in Sainsbury or Waitrose. And that through that, they give cashback through Curve to the customer and we get a small kickback for that. You would find FX, we're still saving money to the customer, but we have a few basis points here and there we're able to share because we're a market maker for FX. Mm-hmm. We're buying and selling treasuries of currencies millions a year, millions on a daily basis. And as we progress in our mission to create this financial marketplace, the operating system for money, and bring more partners inside, you start seeing that the revenue model transition quite significantly from interchange subscription towards platform. Platform will grow very, very
quickly. Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. That sounds like that has the biggest potential. Yeah,
it's going to be like very much like Credit Karma because if you're familiar with Credit Karma, Money Supermarket, Compare the Market.
Well, it's even better than Credit Karma because you're sitting on top of all the transactional and behavioral data, right?
Exactly. The customers continuously engage with the product, whereas with Credit Karma, they're going ad hoc.
Right.
More importantly, Credit Karma only has the credit score data and then data the customer provided, whereas we have all the data across all accounts, including credit score data. And that we also have right access to the account. So I'll give you an example of a product we're going to building with one of the largest banks in the UK, and then we'll start expanding that into Europe, is today, let's say you have three different credit cards, and each card you have a £2,000 revolving debt on each one of them. So you owe £6,000. Now, you and I probably both know that you can go now to any high street bank and ask to refinance that. And whatever loan they will give you, the first quote will be probably 3x better from the interest rate you're paying for the revolving credit card. But people don't do that. And it comes to the question, why not? And it's really because awareness just enough awareness. And number two, enough time, just enough time to go and deal with all the KYC and documentation and due diligence to be able to get it. So those who actually have awareness, they go to the kinds of NerdWallet or Credit Karma or ClearScore or MoneySuperMarket and says, hey, I want a 0% balance transfer card. So check out the process. Let's assume for a second they have the awareness to go to those website. Then they have a questionnaire for 5 minutes to answer. And we have to assume they answered truly, truthfully. And then they have afterwards a list of 10 credit cards. They have to click on each one of them. A new tab will be open. And then now that each tab been opened, they have to, again, fill up a questionnaire, provide data, and maybe 2 weeks later, you're going to get a card. And after you get the card, you then have to start moving the balances from all the three different credit cards to that new 0% balance transfer card that will give you 12 months free cash flow. And with Curve, the experience goes something like that. We see the customer have £2,000 debt, revolving debt on each credit card. Because we see the B number, the type of card number, we know the APR, the interest they're paying on a yearly basis. So we can calculate their borrowing cost. And we can immediately in real time see if we have an alternative offering to the customer. In this case, we found we can have a 0% balance transfer card in their wallet and move the balances, would save them £400 a year. It's a lot of money. And in this point of time, we ask the customer, hey, Zach, would you like to save £400 a year and move your balances? We would, of course.
Yeah.
So you say interested. Then they ask you, is it okay to share your identity information, KYC information, and credit risk data with the partner? You say, of course. Then we ask you, can you approve those terms of service? You say, of course, and done. You now have a new card in your wallet, in the Curve wallet, ready to go. You can spend anywhere you want with that, but we haven't done the job. Now we ask you, would you like to move those balances from all those cards to this new 0% balance transfer card? If you click yes, this is where we end everything. We then credit back the what they owe to each one of those credit providers, and we create a new loan, if you'd like, on the new 0% balance transfer card, give them 12 months free interest. Done. That's it. That's all they have to do. And that's what I meant by personal CFO. We look at your data, we recommend you what to do, you decide what you want to do, and once you decide, we go and do it for you. We moved from a 2 weeks process, very cumbersome, and lack of awareness in the beginning with, into a fully aware, fully intentful, 3-step process within 5 minutes. Pretty impactful. And that allows us to increase competition in the market and allow customers to have just better finances, which hopefully will also improve the entire economy, which is really important.
So you're describing like an embedded finance marketplace where the customer wins because they can shop around and get better deals. You win, of course, because you're the connector. When you speak to banks about this, like this particular bank, how do they receive Curve? Like how much do they know about what's happening in this space? Like how do they, how much is push versus pull when in your conversations at this point in time versus maybe where you were a couple years ago?
So initially, and it's correct to compare today to 2016 when first launch, initially they were all very afraid of Curve, afraid of how they may lose relationship with their customers, afraid of how they will lose customers altogether, afraid of the increased competition. And what we have done with them is we worked to educate them and understand their concerns because, again, remember what I said in the beginning, we are very much of an ecosystem player. Our job not to replace the banks, but help the bank to become better for their customers, make more margins because they're making better decisions, and also our customers make better decisions because they're choosing the right partner. We truly believe there's a match somewhere. Indeed, the market is more competitive, but for the right reasons. It's very similar to the comparison websites like MoneySuperMarket. On one hand, the banks don't like it to compare. On the other hand, it's a great channel for acquisition of customers.
Well, and like Spotify, like you were saying before, I mean, it does have the impact of could have the impact ultimately lowering fees across, you know, across the spectrum.
Hopefully, that's our goal. Yeah. So the business model will change over time. Today, we're getting a lot of pull from banks who wants to our technology, wants to partner with us, see the value, and they're much less afraid of what we're offering because they see we're working hand in hand with the banks to help. We're of course not letting go of the principles about customer obsession and making sure we're creating a very competitive and dynamic market. But yet, we do understand their concerns, and we work with them to either educate them or change things in a product that will make it work for both parties, because it can't just work for the customer and not the partner, because then we'll fail. We have to make it work for everyone in the best way possible. And today we see a lot of those pull from the bank And the sellers understand that what we're doing is the right thing to do because it allows them to reduce the borrowing, the cost of acquisition, increase their margins, doing less mistakes because they have much more data and affordability, so much less losses on lending, for example. And also easier for them to try and produce, create new products in the market.
So, I mean, the example you just described, which, you know, credit card consolidation makes a ton of sense. Is there room also for deposit growth within in your network?
Of course. It's again, not Curve who do deposits because deposits require a banking license because deposit is the way to multiply the economy, as we spoke before. But there's great banks in the world who does that. So our job by offering through Curve, if a bank offers through Curve, bring your checking account and it will give you 2% interest a year on your checking account balance, that's a great way to acquire customers. Mm-hmm. And with Curve, it's very easy to do that because the bank can get data to see what offering they have right now and dynamically offer a unique proposition to the customer based on the current world they have. So for one customer that already have Chase 2% interest, they might offer 3.5%. And for a customer who doesn't have anything, might offer 2% and slowly build a relationship with them. That's exactly that point of connection we can do.
And they get the visibility into the health of that customer as well, right? Like based on the data.
If the customer agreed
saying.
To uh-huh. share the data, and they yeah. usually should to be able to access that, absolutely. But so the way to think about the focus of Curve in the market is that we're working on the following four jobs to be done. That's the focus we have in the following order. The first one is spend, then send, then see, and then save. Spend, send, see, save. There's these four jobs to be done we've focused on. It's about 95% of the jobs to be done customers need to do with their money. Spend is the highest frequent and highest emotional-wise. Dopamine, endorphins kicking in your body when you spend money. And see money, save, of course, is the least frequent. It's very passive, including wealth management inside. And see money, if you were working for Curve and reading the onboarding document, we always say that see money is a negative job to be done. And when we say negative jobs to be done, what we mean by that is that I've never met a person who wakes up in the Monday morning and say, yippee-ki-yay, today is budgeting day. Doesn't happen. And you know that when you have a lot of money, it's no longer you care about the budget. All you care about is how much your money working for you. And it's not even you doing that. You have someone who you pay for, a personal CFO, an investment manager, who tell you how to invest your money and how much your money worked for you. And that's what we want to democratize. That's we want to bring this experience of freedom as much as we can to everyone in the world, which is a huge challenge, but not impossible in our view.
I want to end with somewhat of a personal question. You don't have to go in a personal direction with it, but what gets you motivated every day? What gets you juiced? What juices you? You show up in the office today with the energy you're showing here to meet with your staff in an industry that, you know, for all intents and purposes, I've done thousands of these interviews. It's challenging in its reluctance to change and evolve. The regulations are onerous. Like, what, where do you draw from your personal spirit to come out and show up every day?
So I think there are two sides of the answer here. The first one is around the resilience and grit that one needs to have to solve that. It's a difficult market. It's a very complex problem to solve. As you know, many companies failed, and yet we succeeded. And I explain that point of view. Another one is motivation. I'll start with the grit and the resilience. I'll start with the end. There's a beautiful lecture called The Last Lecture by Randy Pausch. It was an MIT professor. He unfortunately passed away from pancreas cancer. But his doctors told him 3 months before he passed away, or 6 months beforehand, he asked 3 months to live. And he was very young. He had two young children, 3 and 5 years old. And he asked himself, what is the legacy I can keep to my children to teach them about the life, about my learnings in life? And he wrote 10 principles to learn. And one of them, I will never forget, is he said, brick walls are there to prevent those who are not deserving to go over the brick wall. Brick walls are there to be broken, but those who deserve them. And throughout life, I kept seeing these brick walls and always thought about a brick wall as a challenge that only those who deserve are able to get there. And for that, you have to have grit and perseverance and resilience to be able to get there because everyone else will just give up. And that's very much a good reason kind of why I succeeded. It's exactly because of that we succeeded. We just believed in ourselves and kept fighting because we believed that's the truth in the end game and we are deserving to get there. To be able to form the grid, however, I think two elements in my life helped me get there. The first element, of course, was my upbringing. I came from quite a poor family, six children. I'm the firstborn. So I had to always fight and be successful. Never had a back to support me. So if I'm not succeeding, I'm dead in the water. So no one coming to help me mentality. And that upbringing creates a thicker skin. The second thing is really the military. I was very lucky to be selected to a special forces unit. And in that unit, it's a very special one. They break you apart and rebuild you again. And what they break you apart is not the body only, it's the mind and the way you think about the world, that everything is possible. It's all in your mind, mind over body. Mm. And it's easy to say that, and it's very hard to become that mindset. But that mindset is very remarkable. And that's one of the reasons you see Israel as a startup nation. And if you look at the founders, it's very much the same 150, 200 founders. And if you look where they are, they're all pilots of special forces, because this mind over body, this thing, this mindset the military gives you in those units is just second to none. And then I think what helped me with the grid. But with regards to motivation, there's several layers of motivation. The first layer of motivation is that I really like to change people's lives. I enjoy seeing young, ambitious, hungry people who are motivated to succeed, motivated to work hard, understand the sacrifice required to be remarkable at what you do, and you can guide them and mentor them and change their lives. You can get an exit that they cannot buy a house or buy their mom's mortgage, and that will change their lives. And they will remember you when they're 60 years old, they're going to talk about you, how you help mentor them and think about it. And that's one of the legacy. It's very similar to the legacy of a family. The second one, of course, is making money to be successful, because, and it connects to my upbringing. I never want my children to come and ask me for, I want to have this after class English course, and I'm looking at their eyes and saying, sorry, I can't afford it. It will never happen in my lifetime. So it motivates you to work really hard and be successful despite the sacrifice in their heart, the sacrifice by the founder to push the limit. And the last motivation layer is we truly believe we can make an impact on people's lives by making people focus more on what matters in life and create some sort of automation, personal CFO to their finance, maximizing the perceived value for money. They will be able to have more freedom to do what they want, to do whatever they want, whenever they want. I won't be able to make them richer necessarily, but be able to get them more for their money. And that by itself creates a legacy globally. So the legacy is to my children, the legacy to my people, to my employees and partners, my legacy to the world is a big driver that keeps you going even in the hardest moment. And of course, with that, you're not alone. I have remarkable shareholders and team that supports you whenever you're down. They're picking you up. Whenever they're down, you pick them up. It's hard. It's a roller coaster. But with the right support system, nothing will beat you. There's so much things that human beings can do. We just mere willpower. But people just give up too early. They just think it's not possible because someone told them it's not possible. They're not thinking about first principles and curious enough how to be able to make it or believe in themselves. And that mindset with the motivation of creating legacy, I think create a force that it's very hard to go against, has been proven time and time again with curve history.
Shachar, I appreciate that answer, very personal answer. And thank you for joining us on the Tearsheet podcast today.
Thank you very much, Zach, for the opportunity.